podcast, History of Capitalism. Thanks to everyone who's tuning in today. My name is Tiziana Antonietti, and we will be focusing on the topic of work. We are here with a very special guest, German researcher and co-founder of the Berlin-based consultancy SmartWork, Mr. Johannes Kienberger. Johannes, welcome to our 8th episode. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm very excited to be here and, of course, discuss my work with you guys.
We are happy that you were able to make it, and we are looking forward to discussing your newest book on the history of work. Could you maybe talk us through recent trends in the workplace, and what developments would you put on a personal watch list?
So one unfortunate development in the last years is that people feel increasingly disengaged from their work. Also, we have rising rates of burnout. Then another trend I'd definitely point out is the widespread use of technology in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And in addition, the kind of the types of works that we do have changed. I've actually read a widely discussed article by David Graeber, who talks about the so-called phenomenon of bullshit jobs.
Oh, wow. Excuse me. Bullshit jobs? That's a very strong word. What does Graeber mean by that?
So Graeber talks about prediction was made by Keynes, actually, that at the turn of the millennium, technology would be so advanced that all of us could lower our workload to, let's say, 15 hours a week. And we both know that this has not actually happened, you know? So Graeber actually sees the cause of this in the explanation of these bullshit jobs. So in the last decades, productive jobs, such as in the farm sector, domestic servants, something like that, they've largely been automated. And instead of causing an overall reduction of work hours for us to enjoy, there's been a huge administrative sector created and new jobs that we could not imagine a couple of years ago in financial or marketing sectors. And you have an ever-increasing number of people employed in them. If we look a bit closer, Graeber, he argues that these jobs do not actually create value for society, but they're created to keep people busy, which is totally against the usual capitalist logic, which drives towards a more efficient allocation of resources. In addition, he argues that what has changed in society is the feeling that work itself has a moral value. So people increasingly measure their self-worth based on their economic worth compared to previous generations. And of course, it's very difficult to objectify or to identify these jobs that actually have social value. And on the other hand, those that Graeber would identify as bullshit jobs.
Interesting. Let's expand on this for a second. If we follow Graeber's argument, how does this development affect us today?
You know, it actually affects everyone, not just those in bullshit jobs. It's remarkable to notice how people in so-called in non-bullshit jobs like teachers and nurses are paid, two groups that provide incredibly important work in our society today. And people in bullshit jobs, on the other hand, are paid quite a lot in comparison. And some of them might even believe this to be just as you know, others in more, say, meaningful jobs, they have intrinsic value and satisfaction from their work. For them, money would in a certain sense compensate for a lack of social value that you might see in other types of work. You know, I don't entirely agree with Graeber. I think he has certainly a valid point, which could help explain the trends of disengagement and burnout that I previously mentioned. On the other side, we have an increasingly disengaged group that is looking for more meaning in their jobs. And on the other side, we have those who provide very direct social value and find true meaning in jobs. But you see the funds cut and more pressure being put on them. So it's interesting to note that Graeber says the system was not consciously designed, but it emerged over time. And now at the moment is actually serving those who rule in society.
Thanks for expanding on this. I think even in my smaller group of friends, I would have more than one who could strongly fit into the categories you just described. I want to focus on the last sentence that you said here. If today's system was not consciously designed, there were very different systems in the past. On that note, let's dive into the content of your recently published book, From Slavery to Modern Subordination. Please tell us more about these new forms of work in our society and how it is different from previous times.
Well, when I first started to think about the content of this new book, I noticed different types of subordination over the years, and I came up with two main models of subordination. So on the one side, you have the very old one, which individuals were considered capital, what many know as classic slavery. And then on the other hand, which has become the more dominant form in today's society, it's related to the wage system based on the commodification of a person's labor power.
We're really diving deep down here. It's interesting that you mentioned the wage system on this channel. We talk about capitalism every week, and there's the predominant idea of capitalism being closely related to wage labor. But what about the cooperation of capitalism on the one hand and slavery on the other hand?
I actually thought about that when buying a cotton blouse for my daughter. And of course, you might be thinking, what the hell does a cotton blouse have to do with capitalism and slavery? But the relationship is simple, at the same time complex. To have some context, the cotton market in the 1780s, it included various countries, and production was scattered around the world, like in India and China, Brazil. There's actually a very interesting book by Sven Becker. I think it's called something like Empire of Cotton, New History of Capitalism. And it talks about the dark sides of capitalism, such as slavery. He writes about how in the beginning the US was not really part of this cotton market, and then for the US to enter it, many inventions need to be created. And finally, when the country actually became part of it, its different process and system led to reshaping of the entire global market.
So you're saying that when the US entered the cotton market, it soon dominated
Yeah,
it.
yeah.
Okay. How is the US different from its competitors? How did it get there?
You know, it was mainly due to the fact that the US had a certain comparative advantage over other producing nations. So for a thing, its planters could command nearly unlimited supply of land, and also labor and capital, of course. So the territory of the US successively extended, including the southern territories, also had a high inflow of European capital and the possibility to sell to the large European markets. In his book, actually, Becker describes how cotton planters were influential figures and could impact politics in a certain way that many US policies were beneficial for them. And then over time, the labor-intensive cotton market in the US, it grew more and more, and there started to be a shortage and increasing cost of wage labors. So the question was how to solve this problem. And you can guess it was slavery. So from 1790 to about 1850, there was a huge increase in the slave population, especially in South Carolina. You had over 1 million people growing cotton. He phrased it well, very well, in his book, stating that the expansion of cotton reinvigorated slavery. And during this time, enslaved people were completely dehumanized and considered to be more like a capital investment. They were serving as collateral for loans as well. And in the end, slavery in the US not only allowed for lower production prices, but it facilitated access to financial capital, also especially from Europe. Then later, with the abolition of international slave trade, of course, the import of slaves became much more complicated.
So, as I understand, when slavery was still in place, how did the planters organize their production?
You know, the organization of slavery and labor focused on very intensive exploitation to the point that it systematically included women and children, which of course further increased that productivity. And in general, was controlled by the owners through gang labor and punishment of the slaves. Surprisingly, when you compare the labor force at plantations with those at industrial plants, then you notice that work was much more controlled and capitalized with slaves. In other words, the control of workers had its high phase on the cotton plantations of the American South. And while other industries, the employers actually had to work to retain their employees. And slave exploitation could be maximized to the owner's benefit. Manufacturing at the time, you could say, was much more disorganized than plantation systems. And Becker notices in his book that it was actually in the back of cotton and on the back of slaves that the US economy actually ascended in the world.
You mentioned that next to this capitalist system based on slavery in many industries, there were actually contracts of wage labor,
Yeah.
Which is the dominant system today, right? Capitalism is often being equated with wage labor.
Yeah, sure.
Where do you think this thinking come from,
You know,
comes
I
from?
totally agree. It's a very common view today, and based on the domination of large corporations, of course, that we know today. So we mainly think about it as a specific type of wage labor with a modern employer-employee relationship as the point of reference. But throughout history, we can, of course, observe different forms of wage labor. So, for example, during the Industrial Revolution, most production was done by small and medium-sized companies, and employees had they maintained much of their independence and work in a system of what you would call today independent contractors. So relationships were mainly based on merchant labor, with the exception of domestic employees, of course. Thereby, on the one hand, you had employees that were true servants, in the classical sense, bound to the business owner, and then on the other hand, there were contractors hired for specific orders that and they didn't have long-term employment. Importantly, over the 20th century, the system actually began to change. So as we talked before, slavery was eventually abolished, and free wage labor on a contractual basis became the most common form of employment that we know today. But it was a long and very complex process. So wage labor still takes and throughout time took different transitional forms, as for example, the cases of indentured labor or slaves for hire.
So I had the time to look at your book, and there you write that the work as we know it today is particularly related to large corporations, let's say, you know, all of the Fords and Apples of the world. Could you explain that a bit more?
Sure. You can argue that wage labor is particularly suited to corporate capitalism, because in corporate world, the sphere of labor and other areas of life are separated, which was a very new development for most of the population. And besides, what's very different compared to slavery is that instead of subjugating the entire person, the employee would only surrender part of his freedom to the employer. Also, they would do this in exchange for a wage, and this arrangement is generally accepted as an overall improvement and an important historic compromise between subordination and freedom. So overall, the system has led to remarkable improvements of living conditions of most of the working class. And after World War II, we have an interesting pattern in Western countries, with so-called standard employment and private and public sectors being on the rise. So today, for the workers, you have an increasing number of compensations for subordinating their labor, such as low working hours, different types of insurances, and advances in labor rights. This is on the notion of labor that most of us have in mind when we think about modern labor in the capitalist system.
Okay, after taking us through these fascinating developments, would you say that wage labor was an inevitable outcome of the tension between capital and labor?
No, not at all. And that's one of the points I wanted to make before. It's a very long series of cultural and political changes. And in addition, capitalists usually prefer what promises higher and sustainable profits. So under conditions of developed and differentiated market that we have today, it's certainly in the interest of capitalist actors to prefer late wage labor to unfree labor, which is actually what Jürgen Kocka remarked in his very well-known short history of capitalism.
So we talked a lot about the past, but how does the system work in practice today? And why do these tensions still exist?
You know, over time, the acceptable wage, whether workers get sufficient compensation for subordinating their labor and time, has always been debated. Because wage labor can be both liberating and oppressive, of course, depending on who you talk to or at what stage of their life this person is. You have always conflicts about the distribution of the product work, and then, of course, the distribution of power, because even wage labor, the worker remains in a subjugated position. Therefore, I'd really argue against idealizing wage labor, because left to its own devices, capitalism can cause pauperism and threaten social peace. And capitalists can and often do collude against their own workforce.
This sounds a lot like this philosopher that I got to know when I was studying politics at Oxford. Is there maybe any chance you know Robert Castel?
Robert Castel, you mean like the famous French sociologist?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. I think he discussed this issue as well, and he brings up the idea that producers and owners of capital would be able to keep their power by ensuring social peace through services, infrastructure, and so on. So the government does play a vital role in this, and from the 30s onwards, you've seen the emergence of the welfare state, which is so far the most extensive answer to the social question. As it assumes that modern workers can be subjugated as long as social peace is maintained, and they, of course, accept the compromise of trading their time and labor for a salary and for social benefits.
So if we were exaggerating, could we say that whereas before the system was maintained through violence, for example, as we mentioned before when we were talking about the very dark example of slavery on plantations, today workers would be subjugated through their retirement benefits and maybe their dental plan?
I wouldn't stress the dental plan too much, but and then you're painting a very black and white picture here, but of course you could see that as one of the main ideas. So then the wage labor first, you had minimal philanthropic and patriarchal patronage, and nowadays the welfare state has taken much of this role. So of course you have important changes, for example, the legal context. If you've been studying in Oxford, you'll recall Article 22 of the Declaration of Human Rights, which states the right to social security, and the International Labour Organization has the mandate to promote decent work by setting international standards. So yeah, you could say that as the main idea.
And besides standardized employment, what other types of labor could you identify to give our listeners some more information on that?
First of all, it's important to say that it's a very Western development. Of course, it has impacted the rest of the world, but more and more informal and non-standard labor prevails in many countries, and it's also on the rise again in Western nations. Not everybody's working in a regulated, protected environment, and when you look at the most vulnerable members of society, such as migrant workers, seasonal workers, we know that they don't enjoy the same benefits, and the wage contracts are much more precarious. So, even the outsourcing practices by many companies that are used with some highly skilled employees fall into this category. And in many areas where workers are hired and on a contractual basis today, in the past, there would have been a permanent position. So you can say that corporations, they rely on market mechanisms that support non-standardized forms of work, and that's certainly an important issue in the future.
Wow, Johannes, thank you so much for being here. This was very enlightening. For everyone who's listening today, you can find Johannes' book on Amazon as of now. And we appreciate you taking the time to be in our podcast. Thank you so much. We
Thank
know.
you. Thank you. I always enjoy talking about my work, and especially if it involves dentists, like dental plans. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Bye. For the ones who are just tuning in right now, I will sum this session up just a little bit. As we just heard, the regulation of employment relations is based on the existence of a legal subordination between employer and employees. This gives employers all over the world the power to give directives to the worker, control the execution, and sanction their disobedience. Over time, tools of subordination have been diversified and have in many ways become a lot more subtle. In the second part of the podcast, we will discuss these new forms of subordination and control. Therefore, we have invited the very renowned US historian, psychologist, and book author, Lynn Zealand. Thank you so much for coming, Lynn.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very glad you made it. Could you maybe give us some examples which illustrate this evolution that I just mentioned?
Sure, Tiziana. For instance, the distinction between the work hour and off-duty monitoring has become more difficult. If you consider the appearance of fitness trackers like Fitbit, which was recently acquired by Google for $2 billion, I don't know if you've read that, but with some employers sponsoring these for their workers, it's become possible to monitor the employees' heart rate, their sleep patterns, and even their physical activity.
Wow, that sounds very dystopian. Reminds me of George Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, you could easily think of that. And oftentimes, consumers often mistakenly believe that these health data they're sharing are kept private by the companies. But unfortunately, the legislators that we have today cannot keep up with these rapid technological changes, and there are still significant gaps in the protection of this data. For instance, in my country, in the US, we have a federal law called HIPAA, which you probably don't know if you're from the US, but that's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act that does not cover the data shared that companies share with, for example, Google or Apple. Or if I give you a different example, if you consider the so-called positive reinforcements that we have as well, which are the practices of rewarding desirable employee behavior, that's actually just another form of encouragement under certain circumstances that could otherwise be seen as control or pressure. If you imagine your colleague winning an award or getting a nice candlelight dinner in a restaurant or anything like that because they're the fittest employee for the third time in a row, that's a very imaginable situation. And on the other hand, you are putting in the same amount of hours and you're not getting anything. That's not a good feeling, isn't it? So using these kinds of practices is a fairly new development.
And why do you think this has changed?
Well, there's multiple reasons for this change. So first of all, hierarchies today are becoming flatter, and employees don't want their boss to boss them around. Very bad pun. But instead, they want to be able to have autonomy and be involved in decision-making processes. And the employers have thus found ways of accommodating these preferences, which also have positive effect on the workers' productivity. So in this brave new world that you just talked about, a world with increasingly flat hierarchies at work and thus less direct control over the employee, the employers have actually just found different methods to exercise more subtle forms of control.
So are you saying these old days are over? Are there no strict hierarchies anymore?
No, don't get me wrong. Even in the most exceptional flat hierarchies, there are still elements of control, like, for example, seasonal reviews. And without them, you cannot track the progress of your employees or check their performance or anything similar like that. But on another extreme, even subordination in its most like extreme form, as we talked about, or I talked about in my work before, slavery, that still exists around the world. So approximately today, 40.3 million people are still enslaved. And that raises annual profits of around 150 billion. So just imagine the magnitude of that. This takes on various forms, including forced labor, in which people are forced to work against their will, domestic servitude, where people work in domestic households with little or no legal protection, or also bonded slavery, where people are tricked into working for little or no money to pay off their like supposed debt. So bonded slavery is the most common form of slavery today, and initiatives like the UK Modern Slavery Act really recognize this problem. And for instance, they require corporations to report on their supply chains to avoid these happenings.
That's horrific to hear. So you're saying that even the way slavery works has developed and changed in recent times, is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So in the past, slavery was really black and white. You were either 100% a free man, or you were a slave and you were working on a farm owned by somebody else. And that's the so-called chattel slavery. Nowadays, we have a lot of intermediate forms, which are a lot harder to see. So on the extremes, they range from working in a sweatshop under horrific conditions to enjoying actually modern working conditions, but not feeling free somehow. And besides this, I'd also like to mention the important phenomenon that we have of the so-called working poor, whose income falls below the poverty line, even in developed countries. And these people that you probably heard about a lot in the media, they work, but they're still poor. So they sometimes have to work two or three jobs and night shifts to be able to afford their home and food. And they often don't have many other options to get out of this really precarious situation.
Okay, that's very concerning, and I can also tell to our listeners that this is actually on the rise in Western states. It's something that we are in our podcast also observing. And we also talk a lot about the modern welfare state and how it is supposed to alleviate the plight of these working poor and people in precarious situations. If you're starting the system today, if you're stating that the system today is not working well, what alternatives do we have?
So a very prominent example or alternative is the introduction of a universal basic income. So proponents of that would argue that society has the means and even the obligation to provide every citizen a certain monthly income that would cover all of their basic necessities, devoid of any precondition or needs assessment. So they would just get it just because they are human and they exist. It would allow every member of society to freely pursue their intrinsic interests without the constant pressure that we feel of earning a living. And of course, opponents argue that while this sounds like the promised land of milk and honey, the universal basic income will not work in practice. So even if the state could mount the enormous costs of such a program, a significant part of the society would choose to stop working altogether and just rely on this income. So this is as much a philosophical and anthropological question as it is also an economic one.
Well, it is certainly a question that raises quite a few thoughts and emotions. To give our listeners a second opinion on the topic, we asked Martin Hirsch, a former member of the French government and current head of the state's civic service agency, on his opinion on the universal basic income. So let's listen to what he has to say.
Votre opinion sur le revenu universel?
Ah, moi je suis assez réservé sur le revenu universel, tellement c'est compliqué à mettre en œuvre d'une part. Donc une fois devant une audition au Sénat, j'ai dit si j'étais gouverneur de la planète Mars, je ferais le revenu universel, mais comme responsable en France, je ferais autrement. Et la deuxième raison, c'est que je pense que redistribuer tout à tout le monde, ça mettrait en cause tellement de choses qu'on n'y arriverait jamais. Et donc je suis pour qu'on commence par étapes, et donc effectivement qu'on organise tous les minima sociaux pour avoir un seul minima social pour tout le monde. Et je pense fondamental qu'on complète les revenus du travail pour celles et ceux qui sont le moins productifs de la société, pour ne pas les laisser vivre avec pas assez pour vivre. Je ne sais pas si c'est clair.
D'accord, c'est très clair. Mais, et du coup, ça c'est pour la France, mais pour des pays qui sont en voie de développement, est-ce que vous ne pensez pas que ça peut être un booster justement pour relancer l'économie, etc.?
Je pense que c'est compliqué pour relancer l'économie d'avoir un revenu universel quand il y a du travail informel, etc. Donc je pense que soutenir les plus bas revenus me paraît plus utile que d'imaginer un revenu universel dans lequel d'ailleurs il n'y a pas beaucoup de pays qui s'engagent.
En revanche, pour les pays en voie de développement, la protection sociale universelle dans des pays dans lesquels il n'y a pas d'assurance maladie pour tout le monde, dans lesquels il n'y a pas d'assurance quand on a un handicap, pour lesquels il n'y a pas de système de retraite, ça, c'est majeur.
D'accord. Oh, that was really interesting. Well, Martin Hirsch makes some really important points here. Once again, it shows the complexity of the topic. There's not really a scientific solution. And it also raises some broader questions about how we define our key values of liberty and equality, and does liberty entail the free choice of one's lifestyle, regardless of the contribution that we make to society, and even if it includes the choice not to work at all, and does universal basic income translate into more equality in our society?
Speaking of liberty and equality, the future might hold an even bigger challenge. Machines and artificial intelligence are taking over large parts of the traditional job market, and ultimately the subordination of human workers. Are these scenarios realistic in your opinion?
Yeah, so that's actually an excellent question. Many experts expect the automation and the AI to take over between like 20 to even 50% in the coming decades, and that will include jobs ranging from simple administrative functions to even creative professions like journalism or entertainment, so we might just be replaced. While the digital transformation will create new jobs in the process, of course, as well, they usually tend to be high level or require a lot of expertise. So many members of the current workforce will not have the ability to acquire any of those. And some worry about the rise of a new so-called useless underclass of people that will not be needed in the economy of the future.
Now, this sounds like a truly terrible outlook. I'm becoming more and more pessimistic about the future of work. But how can we prevent an oppression of humans by the Terminator, which is what many people are actually fearing?
So actually, there's quite a few ideas on how to cope with such a future. And many of them include redefining the very meaning of work. So some want to expand the term to include activities like parenting or volunteering. And others suggest that a concept of universal basic income, like we just talked about, would be appropriate as well. So in any case, society will need to prepare in advance for the fundamental transformations of work itself, which many argue will be even more profound than the ones started by the Industrial Revolution.
Wow. So on this sobering note, we can wrap things up for today. Thank you so much, Lynn, for coming and joining us here in our studio today.
Thank you for the invitation. I hope your listeners can take something out of the topics that we talked about.
They most certainly will. If anyone wants to learn even more, A Short History of Capitalism by Jürgen Kocher and Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Harari are great reference points. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to us. It truly makes a difference. We are back next week with our next episode on capitalism and transportation. My name is Tiziana Antonietti, and this was History of Capitalism.